The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power by Robert A. Caro, Part 3, continued on cassette number 7, side 1. He had always been very awkward when he ran, and now that awkwardness was on display when he ran out onto the stage as Whedon whipped up the applause. When he had to run up steps to reach the stage, his rear end jutted out so far that small boys in the audience audibly snickered. He practiced endlessly trying to wave his right arm as Roosevelt did, but the gesture emerged so rigid as to be more Hitlerian than Rooseveltian. When speaking, he still jabbed his finger at the audience and bellowed at them, and when he wasn't bellowing, he delivered his text in a harsh, very loud monotone, so that his demeanor was not only awkward but aggressive. During his congressional campaign, he had been able to affect a marvelous empathy with an audience, as long as it was only a few handfuls to whom he could relate individually, but utterly unable to do so when the crowd was larger. And in this Senate campaign, all crowds were larger. His problems were especially marked during his country boy style of talking. Lyndon Johnson's real country boy style was emotional and forceful. The country boy talking he did before these larger crowds was stilted and rehearsed. Even the stories about his father's homilies emerged flat and insincere. Night after night, the enthusiasm of the crowd, whipped up to fever pitch for the candidate's appearance, crested as he ran out on stage and drained away moment by moment thereafter. In fact, not long after Johnson began speaking, the audience began leaving. Farm families started drifting back to their cars. Small boys started playing tag among the automobiles that remained in the square. Another attraction was therefore added to the rallies, one that astonished even Texas political observers who thought they had seen everything. The attraction was money. It was given away to the audience. In keeping with the patriotism theme, it was handed out in the guise of defense bonds and stamps. Every person who attended was given a ticket, and a drawing was held on stage to determine the winners. Although Johnson's ads were careful to explain that the lottery would be held in the interest of the national defense, they emphasized the pecuniary more than the patriotic. A typical full-page advertisement, this one in the Williamson Sun, said that at the big patriotic rally in San Gabriel Park Tuesday night, not only would there be a patriotic review and band music, but, in bold black letters, $25 in defense to be given away. 12 defense stamps in the amount of $25 will be given away free to those in attendance by local citizens who are interested in national defense. Numbered tickets will be distributed at the rally. Be sure to get yours. Get a ticket for each member of the family. The prizes, one saving stamp, $10 value, one saving stamp, $5 value, 10 saving stamps, $1 value. If in rural areas as little as $25 was considered sufficient to attract the citizenry, in cities the amounts were higher. $100 in Port Arthur, for example, $175 in Austin. The new attraction worked. Night after night, the American Statesman commented, Johnson was now addressing thousands where 3 weeks ago he was talking to hundreds. To keep the audience at the rally until its end, despite the dullness of the candidate's speech, the bonds and stamps were not distributed until after the speech. The squirrel cage device from which the winning tickets would be drawn was placed in a prominent position on the stage, and it stood there all the time Johnson was talking. Its presence had the hoped-for effect. The crowds stayed to the end. As the State Observer noted in a description of a typical Johnson rally, despite the heat and the swarms of bugs attracted by the spotlights, 15,000 persons stood crowded together until Johnson had finished speaking. They all kept their eyes on the speaker's stand. They jealously guarded hundreds of lottery tickets. They were all waiting for the free money. The reaction of Texas journalists to free money was summed up in the Granger News's two-word comment, Glory be! National journalists who came to Texas to watch the campaign were more caustic. At political rallies, Johnson drew the crowds by handing out defense bonds and stamps, thereby demonstrating his patriotic fervor and simultaneously proving that he was a handy man to have around between paydays, wrote Jack Wynn in the American Mercury. National journalists were somewhat startled by the campaign as a whole. The current election campaign in Texas to fill the late Maura Shepherd's seat in the United States Senate contains so many elements of the ridiculous that at times it is difficult to take it seriously, wrote Roland Young in The Nation. Time magazine called the campaign the biggest carnival in American politics. But beneath that carnival atmosphere, a grim battle was taking place. Two Johnson tactics, much more subtle than his rallies, were proving much more effective. One was based on the devotion to O'Daniel and the faith in Pass the Biscuits Pappy among the poor people of Texas. Lying in the hospital, Lyndon Johnson had devised a stratagem that made O'Daniel's popularity work against him. Johnson's thousands of workers, not only his teams of paid, expert campaign workers, but the REA employees bringing electricity to the farms, the meter readers of the electric co-ops, the soil conservation experts and county agents, and other federal employees who spent their days traveling from farm to farm, were told to use a new argument. Pappy O'Daniel is a great governor and a great man. We need him in Texas. Let's keep him in Texas. This argument was particularly persuasive when it was linked to pensions. Dozens of weekly newspapers, the only source of news to so many rural families in Texas, made the link by reprinting a Fort Worth Press article sent to them by Johnson headquarters, under a headline suggested by the headquarters. Will the old folks kill their golden goose? Aesop, the old fable teller, may have called the turn on the Texas Senate race. Remember the folks who killed the goose that laid the golden eggs, and then there weren't any more eggs? If O'Daniel is elected senator, he can't be governor anymore. He will have to resign. If the people elect O'Daniel senator, they may be killing their pension hopes. O'Daniel can't be a pension-giving governor and a U.S. senator at the same time. Pappy is fighting for our pensions, a county agent would remind a farm family who had invited him to share their dinner. The legislature is keeping us from getting those pensions. If Pappy leaves for Washington, there won't be anyone left in Austin to fight for pensions. We need him in Austin. But the argument was effective even when it wasn't linked to pensions. For, to many of O'Daniel's faithful, the strongest reason for not electing him to the Senate was their love for him. They didn't want him to leave them, to go to faraway Washington. They couldn't bear to lose him. The argument was working. Recalls one Johnson campaign worker, I said, O'Daniel's made us a good governor. Let's keep him there. I said, don't send Pappy way up there to Washington with all those professional politicians. And that argument really touched. They loved Pappy. They didn't want him to go away. O'Daniel's campaign manager, his Secretary of State, William J. Lawson, saw that the argument was indeed touching. The evidence was piled on a long table in Lawson's office in the Capitol. On his Sunday morning broadcasts, O'Daniel was, both before and after he announced for the Senate, using the tactic that had worked so well for him in his previous campaigns, asking his listeners to write and tell him if they thought he should run for senator. As always, the response was immense. It would begin coming in Tuesday morning and would keep coming on Wednesday. Each delivery brought so many letters and postcards to the post office branch in the Capitol that Lawson would have to recruit a couple of porters to haul the big mail sacks back to his office. Secretaries would go through the mail, dividing into separate piles on the table the replies urging him to go to the Senate and those urging him not to. At first, the piles were very unequal. Lawson, who counted them, says, At first it was maybe 90-10 that he should run for the Senate. We'll support you. Anything you want, we'll help you. This response duplicated that of 1938 and 40, and O'Daniel was sure it would continue, and that the result of those campaigns would be duplicated in 1941. He got a little smug, Lawson says. He didn't think he was going to have to actively campaign. But it didn't continue. The pile urging O'Daniel to run began, day by day, to grow smaller. The pile urging him not to began to grow higher. One day, to Lawson's shock, the latter pile was bigger than the former, and day by day this trend continued. I didn't see any reason why it should change in just 2 or 3 weeks like this, Lawson says. Although he had previously taken little interest in the campaign, believing none was necessary, I went down to the hotel lobbies and the restaurants, frequented by politicians, and over again I heard the same explanation. Well, Bill, here's what's doing it. It seems that Lyndon Johnson's people in all the counties had started this rumor. O'Daniel is a great governor. Why send him to Washington? Keep him here. He'll be more valuable here. Johnson's previous arguments had been too complicated for the people out there to grasp. But just a little simple lie. He's doing more for you than any governor ever did. It'd be silly for us to vote to send him to Washington. They could grasp that, and that spread like wildfire. Johnson saw that it was touching. After just a week back on the campaign trail, he had sufficient confidence in the argument to use it publicly. Over statewide radio hookups, he pointed out that although the federal government would match a state's contribution to Social Security up to $20 per recipient per month, Texas, because of the state's empty treasury, had been putting up only $4.75. Instead of a possible $40 per month, he told his listeners, your pension checks will average $9.50 until the state's contribution rises. The best thing you can do is to keep your governor on the job until you get that $40 a month. And while he's holding that end up for you here, Lyndon Johnson, as your senator in Washington, can work with President Roosevelt toward increased federal pensions. Waving a $20 bill before the audience at his rallies, he said, your governor can't raise that money in Washington. So effective was the argument that Johnson's strategists considered printing up a new bumper sticker, Keep Pappy in Texas, but that tactic was considered too blatant. Soon there was harder evidence that this argument was touching. In McLennan County, for example, a mass meeting of local pension clubs and friends of Governor W. Lee O'Daniel was called to discuss a resolution urging the governor's withdrawal from the campaign, in order, a spokesman for the clubs said, to ensure that a friend of the pensioner would remain in the governor's chair. The governor himself was hardly aware of this threat to his plans. With crucial appropriations stalled by a hostile legislature, the state government was in disarray, and he had pledged not to leave Austin until the bills were passed and the legislature had adjourned. At the end of May, 2 weeks after he had announced he was running, he still had not made a single campaign appearance. His campaigning consisted solely of his Sunday morning broadcasts. Not out among the people, he was not aware of their feelings, nor did he see any reason to be. He had expected to win just by announcing, Lawson said. When Lawson told him he was behind both Johnson and Mann, his reaction was disbelief. It wasn't until he had checked around the state himself that he found that Lawson was correct. He didn't like to lose, Lawson said. He told his Secretary of State to get the campaign in gear. But Johnson's second subtle tactic, one quieter and even more effective than the first, kept those gears from turning. The legislative session had already dragged on far longer than normal, and O'Daniel, sure it would not last much longer, announced that he would open a statewide speaking tour on June 2nd in Waco. But working for Johnson behind the scenes in Austin were two men with a lot of legislators in their pockets. Alvin Wirtz, 1940 head of the Roosevelt campaign in Texas, and Roy Miller, 1940 head of the Stop Roosevelt campaign in Texas. The crucial appropriations bills remained unpassed, and every attempt to have the legislature adjourn or recess was defeated. The governor brought Molly, Mickey Wicky, his hillbilly band, and his big sound truck with the Capitol Dome on top to Waco on the 2nd, but immediately after that one speech, he had to return in it to Austin. Canceling his speaking dates for the following week, he said he hoped he would be able to start his statewide tour by June 9th. During the week of the 2nd, however, no fewer than 8 separate plans for adjournment or recess were presented, and if one was approved by one house, it was disapproved by the other. The governor had to cancel the next week's engagements, too, and then the next. The 1941 legislature was staying in session longer than any other legislature in the state's history. On June 16th, desperate, he announced that he was sending his children out in his place, each with half the hillbilly band. Molly, speaking in Waco the next day, said that Dad got a raw deal from the legislature, which for some unknown reason won't adjourn. But the kids in the band were no substitute for Pappy himself, and many voters were resentful after he had made engagements and canceled them. As late as June 18th, just 10 days before the election, he still hadn't gotten out on the road. Pappy O'Daniel was perhaps the greatest campaigner in the history of Texas, but Lyndon Johnson wasn't letting him campaign. And always there was the money. The free money given away at the patriotic rallies was a very minor item in their cost. There were the salaries of Harfield Wheaton and of the two singers, the harmonica player, the accordion player, and the band or bands. There was the cost of transporting the cast and the flags and the huge rolled-up canvas of the Galveston handshake around the state, which meant the rental of a bus and the salary of a driver. Wheaton had been wary when he was approached to put the show together. I had worked in Texas politics before, so the cash was always in advance, he says. But he had learned quickly that he could stop worrying. The Lyndon Johnson campaign was unlike other political campaigns. There was money available to pay for the talent and the transportation, for much more besides. Johnson wanted big crowds, so he wanted newspaper advertising before each rally. And soon a Houston advertising agency was up to their ears with artwork and getting the necessary plates and mats prepared. And when, on May 26th, Weedon and his troop arrived in Wichita Falls for the first rally, he got a better indication of the financial resources at Johnson's disposal. Four pages had been purchased in each of the Wichita Falls newspapers, and in every weekly newspaper for 100 miles around. Weedon also noticed that in the ads for the All-Out Patriotic Review, presented by Friends of Roosevelt, not one word was mentioned that there would also be an address by Congressman Lyndon B. Johnson, candidate for senator from Texas. And Weedon adds, "Naturally, Congressman Johnson's words were too important to be wasted upon only the few thousand people assembled at the rally, so his speeches were always broadcast, and on a tremendous number of stations which joined together to form a network for each occasion." For 6 weeks, the Lyndon B. Johnson Show was on the road. Big Spring, Eastland, Abilene, Denison, Waco, Dallas, Amarillo, Austin, San Angelo, Corpus Christi, Harlingen, Marshall, San Antonio, and so on, night after night. Man, Texas is a big state. One hop alone from Harlingen to Marshall was over 800 miles, Weedon recalls. And for 6 weeks, the money never ran out. In fact, more and more was spent. A press agent, an ace reporter from the Houston Post, was hired, and advance men were attached to the entourage. And when Johnson's campaign managers realized that Weedon was a celebrity local politicians wanted to meet, he was removed from the bus and flown, along with the press agent, from stop to stop in an oil man's 10-seat Lockheed with built-in bar, so that he would arrive in advance of the troop and could entertain the local VIPs in a hotel suite stocked with whiskey. Weedon was very impressed. Campaign funds of unprecedented magnitude sprang from nowhere, he says. Every aspect of the campaign was being carried on in a similarly unprecedented scale. The banks of typists and telephoners on the Hotel Mezzanine in Austin, and in campaign headquarters in El Paso and Lubbock and San Angelo and Houston and Corpus Christi, the posters and placards with which, as one observer put it, Lyndon Johnson seemed to be trying to plaster the state, the billboards of which new crops blossomed weekly, the newspaper advertising. The impact of the Johnson money was particularly strong on the airwaves, of course. Radio was rapidly becoming the most potent political weapon, but it was a weapon that could be wielded only by those who could afford it. Although Johnson's radio campaign had already been on a scale new to Texas, he wanted that scale expanded, greatly expanded. Mayor Tom Miller was as strong a speaker as he himself was weak. After hearing Miller make one particularly effective speech, he told the mayor he wanted it on the air every day from now until election. "Please contact John Connolly and arrange to make that speech this week over statewide hookup." Roy Hofhines, the young Harris County judge who was one of his campaign managers, was a great speaker. Johnson wanted Hofhines on the air more often. He wanted other supporters on the air more often, and he wanted advance advertising for those speeches, plenty of advertising. So fast was the Johnson campaign spending money that, despite the lavishness with which the campaign had been funded, the money began to run out. At one point in late May, the 12 teams almost had to be brought in off the road. So low were funds that the owner of the rented sound trucks sent dunning letters to Johnson headquarters. Therefore, more money had to be raised. Some was raised in Washington, with the help of a tactic suggested by Wirtz. A recording was made of an O'Daniel speech criticizing Roosevelt, and it was sent to Washington to be played for Corcoran and Rowe, where it had the desired effect of intensifying their enthusiasm for O'Daniel's defeat. Envelopes stuffed with cash cascaded into Texas. So much money was sent, in fact, that Johnson sometimes lost the personal control of its use that was so important to him. Corcoran went up to the Garment District and raised money for Johnson, and we sent it to Texas, via one of the men active in his campaign, Rowe says. Johnson called and said, "Where's that money? I need it." Told the identity of the courier, Johnson grew upset, apparently because the man had authority to distribute funds on his own. Rowe recalls Johnson saying, "God damn it, it'll never get to me. I'll have to meet him at the plane and get it from him." The fate of one envelope in particular caused the candidate to erupt in wrath. On June 20th, Walter Jenkins, who had remained in Washington to run Johnson's office there, left for Texas on Braniff's midnight flight. He was carrying between $10,000 and $15,000. The money, collected by a Washington lobbyist from Texas, was in small bills. I went down to Texas carrying this money and bills stuffed into every pocket, Jenkins recalls. When the plane arrived in Austin the next morning, Jenkins immediately went to campaign headquarters. And the first guy I saw was Charles Marsh. Marsh said, "You got that money? Well, Lyndon has told me to take it." Aware of Marsh's influential role in the campaign, Jenkins assumed that Johnson did indeed want the publisher to have the money, and he gave it to him. Actually, however, Johnson did not. Marsh wanted to use the money for advertising. Johnson wanted it for other purposes, but knew that if the imperious publisher got his hands on it, he would spend it his way. The realization that he had made a mistake dawned on Jenkins when Johnson asked him for the money and informed that it had been given to Marsh, exploded. Jenkins recalls that, "I caught hell from Mr. Johnson," who, Jenkins says, told him that, having been entrusted with a large sum of money, "you turn it over to the first person you see." Conservative lobbyists and New Deal strategists, both groups, were sending cash to Texas to help Lyndon Johnson. This unanimity was displayed in New York, too. The liberal Garment Center leaders sent more money, and so did New York conservatives, who were interested in power. Men who hated Roosevelt and what he stood for, but who needed an in at the White House, and who had been told by Ed Weissel that the way to get it was to back Lyndon Johnson. Principle or power, both found expression in cash for Lyndon Johnson. To obtain most of his new supply of money, however, no tactic was needed, for most of it came from Brown and Root. That firm had made so large an investment in the Johnson campaign already that a further investment was only logical, and it was not only logic that dictated. Herman Brown had thrown himself into the fight, and as his lobbyist Frank Altorf says, Herman didn't want to lose any fights. Yet it was beginning to look as if he might lose this one. He summoned the subs again. Describing Herman's demeanor in meetings with contractors, men familiar with these meetings say that he would say, "I'm putting you down for 1,000, or 2,000, or 5." And if someone balked, Herman would look at the man and say very quietly, "Now listen, we've made you a lot of money." And he got the sums he wanted. He called in his insurance man, Gus S. Wortham, president of the American General Insurance Company of Houston. And Wortham subsequently gave cash to an American General employee who took it to radio stations and paid for Johnson political broadcasts with it. He distributed money to men who knew how to use money in Texas, $4,000 to Roy Miller, for example. Herman Brown didn't ask others to give if he wasn't giving himself, although he appears to have had some qualms about what he was doing. Sometime during these months, a member of the Brown and Root hierarchy called in one of the firm's tax attorneys and asked him if political contributions were deductible expenses. The attorney told him what he already knew, that they were not. But Brown made the contributions anyway, giving more legal fees to attorneys who passed the money on to the campaign, more bonuses to executives who did the same thing. With the campaign roaring to its climax, caution was flung to the winds. Some $7,581 was paid to a subcontractor, W.L. Trotty, as rental for some equipment. Trotty placed the funds in a dormant bank account and made withdrawals to cash. An IRS agent who later investigated believed the cash was given to the campaign, which would be a more transparent device than any previously used. Herman even drew money himself, $5,000 in one instance, and gave it to the campaign through Austin banker Walter Bremond, Jr. No tactic was necessary for Lyndon Johnson in dealing with Herman Brown. All he had to do was ask. No one knows how much Brown and Root gave to the 1941 Lyndon Johnson campaign for senator, and no one will ever know, but the amount was in the neighborhood of $200,000. No one knows how much was spent in total in that campaign, and no one will ever know. But in an era in which the cost of a typical Texas political campaign ran in the tens of thousands of dollars, Lyndon Johnson spent hundreds of thousands of dollars. According to one estimate, $500,000. Johnson's first campaign for the House of Representatives had been one of the most expensive congressional campaigns in the history of Texas. His first campaign for the Senate was the most expensive campaign in the history of Texas. Even in a state in which money had always been a significant factor in politics, his use of money to obtain political office was unprecedented. More significant than the amount of money was its availability. Asked how much money Johnson was given in 1941, Ed Clark says flatly, "All he needed. If he had $50,000 or $100,000 more, that wouldn't have mattered. He had as much as he asked for." Some votes for Lyndon Johnson were being purchased more directly, for it was not only the size of Texas that made campaigning so expensive, but the ethics that pervaded politics in entire sections of it. One of these sections was San Antonio, and the area south of it to the Rio Grande. The way to play politics in San Antonio, as John Gunther was to write, is to buy or try to buy the Mexican vote, which is decisive. The city's west side was a gigantic slum, containing perhaps 60,000 residents, who were paid, Gunther says, probably the lowest wages in the United States. For pecan shellers, San Antonio was the pecan capital of the world, an average of $1.75 per week. It might have been supposed that the support of these disadvantaged people would go to advocates of the New Deal, which was attempting to improve the lot of the disadvantaged. But in fact, they voted at the direction of their leaders, who were motivated mainly by cash. Some of it they passed out to individual voters, $2, $3, or perhaps $5 per vote. A single payment might not be enough, which inspired what Gunther calls a cruel little joke. An honest Mexican is one who stays bought, explains San Antonio postmaster Dan Quill. First, some months before the election, you had to pay their poll taxes, and that was a very dangerous thing to do because they might take your money and then on election day some guy might come along and give them $5 and they'd vote the other way, with your poll taxes. Constant precautions were therefore necessary. In many of San Antonio's Mexican boxes, election supervisors would, in violation of law, stand alongside each voter in the voting booths to make certain that each vote was cast as paid for. Even the supervisors might take a candidate's money and deliver the precinct's votes to another candidate who had paid more or had paid later. The supervisors had to be watched by other men, more trusted men, usually from the candidate's own staff. On election day, careful candidates had men riding the polls in San Antonio, driving from polling place to make sure the candidate was getting what he had paid for. Northern liberals might rhapsodize, as Sherwood Anderson did after one maverick election victory, that he had, through implementation of New Deal policies, bought the West Side's votes in a new and legal way. But in fact, the use of cash had played a not inconsiderable role in his victories, and in 1941 he had learned again the crucial factor in San Antonio elections the hard way. Maury Maverick won when he carried the West Side, and lost when he didn't carry the West Side, Gunther was to write. In 1941, this champion of the New Deal had been heavily outspent by the city machine on the West Side, and had lost it and the election. In 1941, Lyndon Johnson needed the West Side, for he was very unpopular on the North Side, among the city's large and conservative Catholic population. The San Antonio Rotary Club had refused even to let him address it during the campaign. He knew, of course, how to get the West Side. He had himself participated in the purchase of votes on the most basic level, when, still a congressional secretary, he had sat in a hotel room handing dollar bills and $5 bills to Mexicans on behalf of Maury Maverick. Now he had to buy in large lots. He had a good man handling the West Side. Dan Quill had been handling such jobs for a long time. He had begun in 1931 when Clayburgh ran for the first time, and Roy Miller gave him money and told him he was responsible for one of the Mexican boxes. It was right in the heart of Mexican Town, an area dangerous for an outsider even to walk through, the tough little Irishman was to recall 40 years later. That was a real terrible slum. But he moved there, so I could be eligible to be an election supervisor there. I moved into a house there with a school janitor who was also going to be a supervisor. We were scared. We locked the doors. But on election day, he carried his box, and he had been carrying key Mexican boxes for the next 10 years. He knew every trick of the trade, and he knew how much money was needed to get Lyndon Johnson, San Antonio's West Side, vote. We figured we needed $10,000, he says, and that sum was provided. The reason Quill didn't need more, $10,000 was a comparatively small investment in the West Side, was Lyndon Johnson's new alliance with the city machine. The alliance was kept secret, so secret that most of Johnson's closest advisors didn't know about it, but the alliance was solid. With the Kilday's, Mayor Quinn, and Sheriff Anderson on Johnson's side, Quill was excused from responsibility for those Mexican boxes which they controlled, and which would be delivered to Johnson by them. If the leader in a box was a deputy sheriff, for example, We figured he'd control his precinct. We didn't spend any money there. San Antonio, third largest city in Texas, was a key to any statewide election. Johnson may have been unpopular there, but thanks to his foresight when still a congressional secretary years before, now running for statewide office, he could be sure of Quill's 1,500 votes, who ought to follow in the steps of the postmaster. Now he was confident that San Antonio would give him about 10,000 more. South of San Antonio, south even of Cotulla, was the Valley. In the counties that bordered the lower reaches of the Rio Grande, which separated the United States from Mexico, and in the counties which adjoined them to the north, the counties of the South Texas brush country, votes were delivered en masse to a degree true of perhaps no other region in the United States. Only because of the drawing of a border were these counties part of the United States. More than half their inhabitants were Mexican, not merely by descent, but by culture. They spoke only Spanish, and clung to the customs of their homeland across the river. Their tiny, dozing towns, strung like beads along it, bore, one traveler wrote in 1940, an appearance as foreign as their names. San Ignacio, Santa Maria, La Paloma, Los Indios. Their houses were thatched adobe huts or yacales, one or two-room structures of willow branches daubed with mud, around which swarmed goats and chickens and children. In the larger cities, Laredo, Harlingen, they lived in shacks and sprawling slums. Entering these slums was like entering a foreign city. Largely illiterate, they had, as V. O. Key, Jr. noted, only the most remote conception of Anglo-American governmental institutions. One custom prevalent in the near feudalistic regions of Mexico from which they came was that of dependence on a local leader, the patrón or jefe. From time immemorial, they had given obedience to the head or overseer of the ranch, one observer wrote. They continued this custom in America. In this region of great ranches, where so many of the Mexicans worked, the King Ranch, which extended over four of the counties in this region, alone employed more than 700 vaqueros. El patrón was often the ranch owner. The cattle barons, Weeks wrote, established themselves as lords protector of those Mexicans who became their tenants and ranch hands. The resulting relationship was feudal, with the vaqueros giving unquestioning loyalty to the ranch owners and regarding their wishes as law, the only law he knows. But some of these patrons were political bosses, ruthless, in some cases vicious men, who stalked the streets of the dusty little towns in their domains, surrounded by armed, unshaven pistoleros. Politics was violent in the valley. A reporter from Philadelphia who journeyed there in 1939 found as hard-bitten a political crowd as Texas ever saw. Each county has its own iron-fisted boss, which would make Philadelphia's Jay Cook or New York's Jimmy Hines look like pikers. The most famous among them, the valley's boss of bosses, was George Parr, son of Archie Parr, the legendary Duke of Duval, and now Duke in his own right. The Parrs had ruled Duval County since 1912, when Archie sided with the Mexicans after an Election Day massacre in San Diego, the county seat, had left three of them dead. But others, less well known, had been in power even longer. Among the petty despots who ruled along the Rio Grande, Judge Bravo of Zapata County, Judge Raymond of Webb, a figure, one chronicler wrote, so secretive that little is known of him except rumor, who ruled Laredo with an iron hand, Sheriff Chubb Poole of LaSalle, the Guerra Boys, four brothers who ran Star County, were some whose families had held power in their dusty duchies for half a century. On Election Day, Mexican-Americans were herded to the polls by armed pistoleros, sometimes appointed deputy sheriffs for the day. Each voter was handed a receipt showing he had paid his poll tax. Usually these taxes had been purchased by the jefes months before and kept in their safes to, as Key puts it, ensure discipline and orderly procedure. In some precincts, these voters were also handed ballots that had already been marked. According to one description, the Mexican voter was marched to the polls, generally by a half-breed deputy sheriff with 2 6-shooters, a Winchester rifle and a bandolier of ammunition, to perform the sovereign act of voting. He entered the polls one at a time, was handed a folded ballot which he dropped in the box, was given a drink of tequila, and then was marched out, where he touched the hand of one of the local political bosses or some of his sainted representatives. In other precincts, matters were managed less crudely. The voters were told whom to vote for, but were allowed to mark their own ballots. Of course, the guards accompanied them into the voting cubbyholes to ensure that the instructions were followed. Even if the voter was allowed to cast his ballot in secrecy, he had little chance of escaping unnoticed if he disobeyed instructions. Each ballot was given a number that corresponded to the number on a tear-off sheet attached to the ballot, and a voter had to sign his name on the sheet before it was torn from the ballot and the ballot cast. This procedure had been enshrined in Texas law ostensibly to keep a person from voting more than once, but it also allowed the election judges to know, by matching the tear sheet to the ballot, how a citizen voted. Some jefes dispensed with all this bother. An attorney for one of them, who let his voters keep their poll tax receipts, recalls his procedure. Go around to the Mexicans' homes, get the numbers of their poll tax receipts, tell them not to go to the polls, just write in 100 numbers and cast the 100 votes yourself. The number of votes at the jefe's command was not necessarily limited by the number of eligible voters. Another advantage of the poll tax system to the Valley machines was that after the age of 60, a voter did not have to pay the tax. Poll tax lists were checked only irregularly to eliminate the names of those who died after 60, and, in the words of one expert on the subject, when an election was close in Texas, in the Valley, the machine votes the dead man. Nor were all voters even American citizens. On election day, the saloons of the Mexican town of Reynosa, across the Rio Grande from Hidalgo, were cleaned out, and truckloads of Mexicans were brought across to vote in Texas. Star County was also an excellent location for bringing voters from across the border, the commentator notes. In Webb County, the small town of Dolores had about 100 American citizens, and in some elections recorded as many as 400 votes. As a result of such tactics, the vote from the Valley, a vote which generally went all one way, the jefes had learned to stick together to maximize their impact and influence on Texas politics, rarely displayed the diversity of opinion associated with a democracy. Some 15,000 votes were generally believed to be controlled in the Valley, and it was not unusual for them to go to a favored candidate by margins as large as 10-1. The decisive consideration was cash. The power of these petty despots was matched by their greed. Not content with siphoning off hundreds of thousands of dollars from every aspect of municipal government, the PARs treated the county budget virtually as their own personal bank account, says one Texas historian. The PARs collected a nickel tax on every bottle of beer sold in Duval. Visitors inquiring why beer, 20 cents everywhere else in Texas, cost 25 cents in Duval, were informed that the extra nickel was for George. To some of these despots, votes were a commodity like any other, a commodity to be sold. According to the best history of politics in the Valley, the state candidates who have the most money to spend usually carry these machine counties. In 1940, O'Daniel had carried them, with their customary unanimity. George Parr's Duval County, for example, had given the governor 3,728 votes, to a total of 180 for the other 7 candidates. But in 1941, efforts were being made to ensure that these counties would be carried by Lyndon Johnson instead. These efforts had begun almost as soon as the campaign had begun. Brown and Root played a hand in them. On April 23rd, the firm's labor director informed Johnson that one block vote, the state's captive labor unions, had been secured. Statewide labor vote assured, but no noise. And added, Latin American support in lower counties is next objective. Looks easy. For a while, with Mann refusing to buy votes and Dyes refusing to take an interest in buying them, this assessment proved correct. On May 9th, Johnson headquarters was assured by a scout it had sent to the Valley that this district is for Lyndon Johnson. The George Parr machine, the scout said, is very active for Johnson. The entrance into the campaign of the Valley's 1940 favorite changed the situation. Nor would this be the first time that the Valley's commitment to a candidate had been changed by a later, higher offer from another candidate. But Alvin Wirtz was an old ally of the Parrs. He had personally negotiated with old Archie, with whom he had served in the state Senate, for the Parr-controlled votes in Nueces County in the 1928 Democratic attempt to defeat Congressman Harry Wurzbach, which failed when Wurzbach made charges of election fraud stick. When, with Johnson hospitalized and the campaign in crisis, Wirtz rushed to Texas, he stopped over in Dallas, where he held a meeting with the campaign's treasurer, oilman Lechner. Then he disappeared for several days. Only later would puzzled newsmen learn that during these days Wirtz had been in South Texas. No one can say with certainty what he was doing there, although according to sources whose information on other, more verifiable Wirtz activities invariably proves correct, he and O'Daniel's supporters were engaged in a bidding war for the Valley's votes. Lyndon Johnson himself contacted George Parr on the telephone at least once, in the presence of Polk and Emmett Shelton, two of Parr's attorneys. By June 18th, the situation had been resolved. Horace Guerra of Starr County, Parr's principal ally, assured Johnson, "You can depend on my and my friends' wholehearted support. I predict Starr County will give you a substantial majority." If O'Daniel could use the popular revival meeting tune, "Give Me That Old-Time Religion," Johnson could too, and his lyrics incorporated the name that in Texas was second in potency only to Christ's. "Franklin D. and Lyndon B., they're good enough for me." With Pappy having entered the race, moreover, Johnson felt he needed increased support from Franklin D., and he got it. Asked at another Oval Office press conference if he had any additional comment on the Texas race, the president smilingly replied that he thought that he had done a good job the first time and was quite certain the people of Texas understood him. Their understanding was facilitated by a description of the press conference written at Johnson headquarters and run verbatim by scores of obliging weeklies under a headline also written at headquarters, "FDR Endorses Johnson." Roosevelt also decided that Steve Early should reply to a letter from a Texas voter who had inquired if Johnson was indeed the president's choice. Although he was still unwilling to have his support stated flatly, Roosevelt directed Early and James Rowe, who was helping to draft the reply, in precisely what words to use, so that his support would be clear nonetheless. And to ensure that it became public, he told Rowe that if the voter did not release Early's letter, Johnson could release it himself. The letter said, "At a press conference several weeks ago, the president made his position perfectly clear. He told the newspapermen that he is not taking any part in the Texas primary, as that is solely a question for Texas to decide. In answering the question, the president stated something which everybody knows to be true, which is that Congressman Lyndon Johnson is an old and close friend of his." Because of O'Daniel's entry into the race, another presidential letter was requested, this one to help Johnson counter the strength with the elderly that O'Daniel possessed because of his pension plan. Rowe balked at this request. He was continually being pushed by Johnson and Wirtz for greater presidential involvement in the campaign, and he had, over and over again, given them what they asked for. Now he was fearful that he had gotten the president too involved, and he felt that in the suggested wording of this letter, Johnson had gone too far. It attributed to the junior congressman a totally non-existent role in the fight for Social Security. "I thought he was asking too much. I said, 'God damn it, Lyndon, I can't do too much. We've done so much for you already. I can't go back and ask for this.'" He refused to do so and even sent the president a cautionary note. "The polls show Lyndon leading at this time, but I suspect they are Lyndon's polls." But Johnson only used other avenues to reach the president. 4 days later, the letter comes out anyway, Rowe says. "He just went right around me." This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.